Good morning, Montreal. It's Beryl Wiseman sitting in for Aphrodite Salas today. We're going to be examining a host of issues from local to international, but the first two are things that affect our daily lives and could have a great effect in the next few weeks. We're going to examine first a ruling that is supposed to come down today from the Supreme Court of Canada on whether fault should be brought back into divorce law. Can a divorce from a cheating spouse be so debilitating that it renders a person unable to work even years after the infidelity? And should the other spouse be made to pay for it? Now, this concept of fault has been out of our law for a number of years, and we're going to speak to lawyer Linda Hammerschmidt in a moment about the consequences of this decision. We're then going to go and examine the question of identity theft and our personal information, not just in the context of the recent stories on Equifax information being stolen, national bank files being found by somebody in the garbage, but whether the information we give to credit agencies, whether the information we give to landlords, all the stuff that's floating out there, is really safe? Do we are identities at risk even when there is no theft? We're also going to be looking at Iran and how it's mocking the Human Rights Council of the United Nations and what Canada should be doing about it and what our response should be, particularly in light of the Kazemi case. But first off, we go to lawyer Linda Hammerschmidt, who's with us today to discuss the Leskin case, and that decision is coming down today. Good morning, Linda.
Good morning to you.
What are the consequences of this case if the Supreme Court rules that, yes, this woman, Mrs. Leskin, was so debilitated by her husband's infidelity and his demands for a divorce that she couldn't work, so there should be an extra penalty on top of that, on top of a needs test?
Well, first of all, not that I'm clairvoyant, but I don't think that that's what they're going to do for a number of reasons. First of all, they don't make the law, and the law is quite clear, so unless the legislature decides to change those provisions of the Divorce Act, I don't think that that's going to be what the ruling is. Secondly, she wasn't so debilitated, because I attended the case when it was pled before the Supreme Court, and she represented herself, and in her own words, first of all, she made it quite clear that the misconduct that everybody has gripped from
I like that word, gripped.
Gripped from the case and used as titles on media, news reports, or in the newspapers, had nothing to do with whether or not there was a question of adultery or an affair or whatever. It had to do with financial disclosure. So her complaint is that his misconduct was that he didn't disclose all of the money that he supposedly did or didn't have and where it was and all this, and as a result of that, she should still have support.
So when did the sort of whining aspect come into this, that she's so debilitated by his infidelity that she's not been able to move?
I think that's the media, quite frankly, no offense, because she herself also said she didn't.
Well, she wrote the court that she
lose her job, and she didn't, and she wasn't so debilitated that she couldn't work. She chose to leave her job at the TD Bank voluntarily.
I'm glad you used that word choice, and this is what irritates me about this case. She chose to leave it and then wrote the court that, quote, I'm bitter to the point of obsession with his misconduct and the consequences, but unable to make a new life.
Yeah,
if she can't handle it,
talking about financial disclosure.
Right, but she's trying to make a case for some emotional damage. Now, she can't, you know, suck it up and deal with it to whatever. Why should the law intervene? How could she even ask the law to intervene?
Well, particularly in this case, because I don't feel it's as sympathetic as somebody who perhaps never worked during a marriage, and that's more understandable, and didn't have a career, but this woman worked for 34 years. It's not like somebody in the old traditional school that they had an agreement between them. The husband worked. The mother stayed at home. She took care of everything. And 35 years later, they decided to part company, and she has no skills and needs to be supported. That's quite understandable, and she should be. But somebody who had a job after 34 years and decided to quit for whatever reasons, even if, you know, it's health-related, there were other jobs she could have had that she has a back problem, apparently, that could have been dealt with her employer in another position, and she chose no, and then she gets a severance package, she spends it all, and then she comes back and say, well, you know what, I'm upset now, and I want more money.
Do anything. Linda, please stay with us. Montreal, we want to hear from you whether a situation like this is even something should be reviewed by the highest court in our land. We'll be right back after this. Montreal, we're back. We're talking to lawyer Linda Hammerschmidt about the Leskin case. It's a decision that's supposed to come down today from the Supreme Court, which may, in a skewed kind of way, bring back the concept of fault in divorce. But Linda, as you pointed out, Mrs. Leskin's arguments were not about his Mr. Leskin's infidelity. They were about his hiding assets and money.
According to her. According to him, obviously, he didn't hide anything. And the other thing that we should bear in mind is, you know, if Mr. Leskin had been the person to have quit his job for whatever reasons, they'd throw him in jail. You know, but I hate it when they make, you know, as a woman, I don't like the cases where it makes women be, oh, poor us. Because on the one hand, there's a bunch of women out there working to try to lift the glass ceiling and have right. equal opportunities. And every time we get any closer, it seems like we're sidetracked by somebody who says, you know what, I quit my job, but poor me, and this guy should pay. It's like, you can't
Linda, you know, we're being terribly politically incorrect. Are you saying that women are crying wolf?
Not all of them.
Not all of them, no.
In the example from before, there are people that actually should have, you know, permanent support in one thing or another, but not somebody who takes an adult choice and quits their job and then asks somebody else to pay for it. Because if Mr. Liskin quit his job and she was still working at the Toronto Dominion Bank, would he be able to come and ask her for support?
No, he'd be whacked.
He'd be saying, get the hell out
he'd
of my place.
He'd be whacked. You bring up an interesting point, and you mentioned it in a previous segment, of how, as you said, the media kind of skewed this story to be a story about infidelity when it's not. How do you think that happened? How do you think that got skewed?
I don't know, but I can tell you that there was an article in one paper on Valentine's Day, the day before the case was actually heard in the Supreme Court,
right.
whose title was Cheating at the Heart of Ex-Wife's Trauma. Now, where did they get that? Because if they had any idea what the case was about, but it was Valentine's Day, you know.
So the story had to fit.
Yeah.
Alice in Wonderland, sentence first, trial after.
And it's a square thing, just hammer it in until, you know, the sides fit or whatever. It's not fair. But quite frankly, if there was an issue of misconduct, which I do not believe at all that it's ever going to come back into our law, God willing, that it should be reciprocal. Because if, for example, we always hear the complaints that the finances, it's the men that are at fault. Well, the opposite flip side of that coin is usually the access problems. It's the woman at fault. So you could then say if there's misconduct by a parent who doesn't allow the other parent to see their children, then there should be some financial repercussion for that. The whole thing will just deteriorate and will become the United States, where everybody's hiring private detectives. There's a whole agency I read last week in the United States that's getting great success, a bunch of women, 100 women detective agency, and they're all out there with their little cameras and everything and their brassieres and all. Is this what we want in Canada?
Linda, it's amazing you should say that's the first thing that I said yesterday when I was talking to Rick McConomy. I know he's a friend of yours as well as mine, and mm-hmm. and he's co-hosted my show on Sundays with me, and I said that's going to be the first result. Private investigators out there with their cameras absolutely having orgasms of ecstasy over this new work that they got, looking over everybody's shoulder at every single thing they do and just tabulating what every infidelity and what every improper action, in quotations, could be worth.
The courts now are upset because our cases are taking longer and longer to be heard, and 5-day cases, for example, are now only being heard in 2008. If we add this extra quotient into there, we'll be in 2010 before anybody can get a normal divorce. It's going to be a nightmare. But
what was the expression in Leskin's appeal that it'll create a legal tsunami of review applications?
Well, absolutely, because all those people whose doors were allegedly shut with the Miglin judgments, supposedly, will be flying back to take another kick at the can.
Have we had a little bit of this legal tsunami, by the way, in the past few years, ever since we've had this change of circumstance, which has become law in several American jurisdictions, but is now being used in Canada to reopen closed divorces, some as old as 20 years?
Well, change of circumstances depends on, you know, every courtroom is an entity unto itself, no matter what province you're in. If you're in front of somebody, they're the master of their domain, to quote Steinfeld. And, you know, so it doesn't really matter what the higher court says sometimes. If that's what's happening, or the facts fit something else, or somebody wants to say something, the judgment's going to start off on the ground floor in a particular way. And only those with great pocketbooks can take it all the way to have something rectified. So.
Now this change of circumstance, which is legislative change in some American states, where somebody can reopen an old divorce if their circumstances changed. We don't have that legislation in Canada, but lately there's been some judges who've been picking up on this trend.
Well,
why?
Well, not so much legislation. We do have provisions in the Divorce Act that says that if there's a circumstantial change that's above and beyond, then you can certainly look at it. If you didn't know something at the time of the trial and you only found about it later that would have influenced the judgment in another way, that's something else. I mean, obviously this applies to people who had contested cases and not people who signed a consent necessarily, because they're supposed to have done their due diligence and know what they're doing. Which isn't always the case, I'm going to add. But, you know, there's always somebody. It's like anything. You can take a case and you have no merit, even in civil litigation, but you take it
and
for the hopes that the other side will pay to keep you out of court.
Yep. Linda, stay with us. We'll be back right after this on Montreal. We want to hear from you about your experiences in divorce law and family cases, if you've had them. We'll be right back. Montreal, it's Beryl Wiseman sitting in for Aphrodite Salas, and we're talking to lawyer Linda Hammerschmidt on the Leskin decision that's supposed to come down to the Supreme Court today on whether or not anything should be introduced into divorce rulings other than need, whether fault might creep back into our law. Linda, let me ask you something that could stir the pot a bit, or a bit revolutionary, I was about to say. What if we reach the time where, to clear out the courts, to clear out the backlog, and family law is such a huge body of work and time in our courts, what if we ever had it came to the point in law where the government said, two people are living together, we don't care if you're a man, a woman, two men, two women, a man and a goat, doesn't matter. You don't have a contract in writing, we're not involved. We're the government, and since Magna Carta, the state is involved in contract law as the basis of human affairs. You were too stupid not to make a contract. We're not imposing any regimes on you. We're not imposing anything. Hasta la vista, bonjour la visite, goodbye. Can we ever reach that point, you think, and should we?
No.
Okay, why?
Short answer.
Why?
First of all, I've done wedding shows, and you may laugh at that, a divorce.
What's a wedding show?
But we go there.
Wait, what's a wedding show?
You know, the wedding shows that are put on by Let's Get Married and Marry On New and all
you mean,
of that.
You mean these wedding, these things like in
you know, where they sell bridal stuff.
Yeah. And what were you doing there? You were modeling, right?
No, I go there for this purpose, to encourage people to get marriage contracts before, so that they set down everything that in the beginning. So there's a point of departure in case, because 50-50, they're going to need to see somebody like me. So they should be prepared from the beginning.
Now, if Montreal should know, if they haven't got a marriage contract, they get married in Quebec,
they're in a partnership of bequests, and that's not a good thing necessarily.
Explain what that fancy phrase means to our listeners.
It means that basically, and I'm not going to get into all the, tons of paragraphs in the civil code about it, but that 50-50, everything during the marriage accumulated belongs to, you know, both parties. So the values have to be put together and then divided in two. It's much more complicated than that, but basically that's the premise. So if you get a marriage contract that says you're separatist to property, you don't have to go through all that arithmetic and what's
right.
Yours allegedly is yours and what's yours is the other one's. However, family patrimony then comes in to override that in part, but only in five categories of assets. But especially people who are in business or anything like this, the last thing you want to be in is partnership of bequests. My philosophy has always been, you're born alone and you die alone, and you, in the middle, you take care of yourself.
Perfect.
So if you can't take care of yourself financially, because that's the biggest cause of divorce, and if you feel financially autonomous in your marriage, the chances of the stress factors that are already there are going to be so much lessened that you'll stay married. So why are you, if you're so in love, why don't you want to do something to encourage yourself to stay married? So fix it, it's prevention. Fix it in the beginning, and it won't break maybe in the middle.
Even if you're not in love, you're just in lust.
Well, if you're in lust, probably it's not going to last anyway, in which case, don't get married.
Oh, you're a romantic, Linda.
Well, I'm a pragmatist, more I would prefer to call myself. Because, you know, people, somebody was telling me yesterday about somebody that they knew that met somebody in last May. They got married in September. They were separated by October. What was that all about, except unless they just like to have a party with gifts?
The experience of it?
Yeah, well, then just throw a party. You don't need to get married to have a party.
So we shouldn't hold our breath about this decision, and if the court, you know, is of sound mind, then things will stay as they are by the end of the day.
Hopefully. And by the way, to get back to your point about the government intervening, if you don't have, in Quebec, the rest of the countries.
Oh, here it
but
comes. Here it comes.
Verbal contracts are binding.
You
bet. Don't need to put it technically in writing, but the problem arises.
Proof.
Proof, exactly. So down the road, 20 years ago, he told me, Anna, and there just was a case that was heard in Superior Court, that the man said that we modified our written agreement after we got divorced, and I was going to only pay for 20 years, and then it was over, but they didn't write anything down to that effect, and 20 years later, he wanted to make it formal that I no longer pay you, and of course she contested and asked for an increase. So where's the proof?
Amen. You know? Linda Hammerschmidt, thank you very, very much for being with us this morning.
Have a great day.
Montreal, we'll be back with you after the news. Good morning, Montreal. Beryl Wiseman here sitting in for Aphrodite Salas. Identity theft, privacy, our personal information. A lot of that in the news past few days. Equifax, 2,000 files disappearing. National Bank, instead of shredding documents, puts them in the wrong garbage bin. They're found, thankfully, by an honest citizen. Privacy Commissioner Jennifer Stoddart says far too much information is being given by our customs agents and shared with Americans and just about anybody else. But the question is, even if there wasn't theft of records from credit card agencies, even if banks didn't leave documents unattended and in the wrong bins, how much of your information is going to haunt you forever? Credit card agencies get to put almost whatever they want in their files about you. Anybody can call in. Information is taken. Information is entered. They're supposed to allow you a 50-character explanation for anything gone wrong on your file. Rarely does it appear. Your file is kept open for 7 years. There are criminal files that are cleared out faster. They never send you information on anything strange in your file. How many times did all of you get really, really reamed by credit agencies? You go in for a car lease, you go in for a loan, you're told no, and you're not told why. And to discuss this question of personal privacy and our personal information, we're joined by arguably Canada's leading constitutional and civil liberties lawyer, Julius Gray. Julius, good morning.
Good morning.
How bad is the problem in Canada, and is it worse than other countries?
Well, I don't know if it's worse than other countries. I think the problem is a serious one, and the problem is called technology. It's not a problem you can resolve saying, well, we'll pass a law or pass a regulation. In fact, we pass too many regulations on certain aspects. For instance, the lobbying laws are a way of preventing people from on grounds of all sorts of theoretical things. Technology is the problem, and technology cannot be stopped. Throughout history, every time people tried to smash machines or do anything, it didn't work. So what we must find is a way of controlling technology. Technology has all sorts of terrible effects. For instance, I don't know if you noticed, grades in French, and I'm sure in English, are going down because people don't write anymore. They just write emails. The style of the old telegram style has become the English and French style
but
of our time.
But technology has a two-edged sword. On the one hand, as you say, it allows for too much information to travel. It allows for general approaches to people to be curtailed. But doesn't it also make it easier, for example, in the case of credit card agencies, doesn't it make it easier for them to transmit information back to the consumer and say, hey, there's some problems in your file, here it is, take a look at it, and we'll set it right if something's wrong. And yet they're not obligated to do that, and they don't.
But even if they were obligated to do it, would they do it? And how important would that be the obtaining of information? You see, the real problem is this. But when you have too much information, technology does wonderful things. I mean, just look at chemotherapy and so on. Anybody who thinks we're going to go back to a campfire in a cave is a fool as well as a hopeless dreamer. But the difficulty is that people have a mentality which is where there's smoke, there's fire. It's enough for you to be charged, and that's on internet, and that's and they'll assume you were guilty and you got off.
Or to have an R9 on your credit file, and I'm going to make a suggestion to you in one moment when we come back right after this.
Yeah.
Montreal, Beryl Wiseman sitting in for Aphrodite Salas. We're talking about privacy rights, your identity, information floating through the ether. How many times you've been reamed by credit agencies and you don't know why. We've had a week of Equifax having files stolen, National Bank putting gold files into bins that should have been destroyed, the Privacy Commissioner talking about our customs information being shared with countries. We're talking with constitutional lawyer Julius Gray. And Julius, I just wanted to make this suggestion and tell me if this can work. Revenue Quebec a few years ago demanded from merchants that they fill out a form on subcontractors, and that form was attached to their TVQ forms that came every month. And if you didn't fill it out, you were hit with a $2,500 fine. Now, why isn't it possible to have those same kind of fines on credit agencies for failing to give the full information to consumers or for failing to include the 50-character explanations they're supposed to?
Well, I suppose you could do that. You could
wouldn't that concentrate?
You'll have many fly-by-night operations that aren't afraid of that. But secondly,
but there aren't. The whole industry is controlled by
secondly,
two companies.
It seems to me that whatever explanation you give, people will still say, I don't really want to. He went bankrupt before. He says it was because you know, it was misfortune. But why take a chance on him? And the same thing applies to any criminal record or anything else. What we're going towards is the glorification of the mediocre person. The person who's always been so cautious, never did anything. And even then, that mediocre person will be subject to a malicious tongue putting something on the net.
In other words, we're going in, it's a society of innuendo.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And the other problem, of course, is what are you going to do? Even if you put in a law about fines, if somebody puts something on in Bangalore, and they will. And
they
therefore
will.
You'll be able to find out everything that happens. We've got to have a moral revolution by which we do not care. We don't have such a vengeful society. We don't assume that a record means that a person is worthless. We don't assume that a single bankruptcy means you can't lend somebody money. We can certainly make rules, and we should make rules, forcing banks to lend to higher risk individuals and not just the safe things. But all of these things will not work unless our society agrees that with the overwhelming amount of information, we have to pay less attention to some calumny than we used to in the past. We've got to be able to get over it and say that doesn't prove anything. And,
we need a society, in other words, that values compassion over contempt.
Compassion over that, over efficiency, over market convenience, and which understands, a society which understands that just because it's on the net doesn't mean it's true. In the old days...
Julius, we're just going to take one call. We've got Ted Wright of Westmont Legal joining us. Ted, welcome.
Hi, glad to be with you, and glad to be with Maître Julius Gray, one of the best in the world here.
I think so. We can agree on that.
He's shy. He won't say that.
I won't say that.
No, but we can.
Yes.
So, Ted, what do you got to say on this topic? How bad is it out there?
Well, it's bad.
Besides information overload.
Yeah, it's bad because, like, I deal primarily with legal stuff in regards to tenant-landlord relations. And landlords have a tendency to ask for as much information as they can get, even though their application forms are illegal. Like, when they come to the legal clinic, we counsel them and say, don't do that because if anything happens, you can have damages against you at some point in the future.
And landlords do ask for information that they're not even allowed to ask for, and tenants don't even know they don't have to give it.
No, they don't have to give it. The only unfortunate part of the residential lease contract is if you don't give information that they want, you don't get a lease. And there's no penalty in law for that except for various discriminations. But for not providing information that's illegally asked for, you can get the information and nothing happens at all.
And there's no redress. This isn't a rental board issue. There's just nothing. You're out.
Well, it's supposedly under the Commission d'accès à l'information, and it's got here, I'm going to quote exactly from their document, although the Commission does not have the power to order a landlord to pay damages or compensation, its intervention generally leads to the adoption of practices that are more respectful of the law. However, we've had bunches of landlords who just say, goodbye, I don't want to talk to you.
Ted, you've seen a lot of, you must have seen a lot of problems on the point that Julius was making earlier, that we're a society by innuendo, so if a landlord asks for a letter of reference of a tenant, and the tenant doesn't have one, there's an automatic assumption that, well, there must be something wrong. It's like we're all a bunch of snitches looking over each other's shoulder.
That's right, and you know what's even happening now? You have landlords who, they don't want to say anything about anybody, and they'll say, yes, the person paid the rent. And then the landlord says, oh, there's a problem. It's getting really bizarre out there, as Maître Gray said.
Julius Gray, you use the expression, the necessity for moral revolution. How do we get people to act, not just complain? Everybody I know, literally everybody I know, save one or two people, has been a victim of information abuse, of innuendo, of credit issues, and yet more than complain privately, they won't move.
Well, we have to have courage. We have to say things, even though those things may not be in our interest and may make their way to the net where somebody's going to pick it up and say, look what he said. And we have to organize and educate people. It is a job, it's not an easy job. I said technology cannot be stopped. Education is a long process. The only way to deal with it is through this sort of education, a certain degree of idealism, and personal courage.
And then, Julius Gray, Ted Wright, we'll be back with you right after this. Montreal, good morning. Beryl Wiseman sitting in for Aphrodite Salas. We're talking about privacy, credit files disappearing, bank files in the wrong bin found by strangers, privacy information given by our customs guards to foreign governments. How much is enough? Ted Wright is with us with Westmont Legal Clinic. Ted, even in your domain, is there any chance that we're ever going to get back to realization? And I just want to quote this beautiful line from Justice Louis Brandeis, who once wrote, "We must recognize the significance of man's spiritual nature. All civilized systems of law confer upon man, as against their governments, the right to be let alone, the most comprehensive of rights and the most valued by civilized men." Have we just gone too far? Are we getting into everybody's underwear to the point where we're just going to crack up one day?
Well, I think so, because we used to be founded on the Judeo-Christian principles of fairness and justice, but we're getting so far away from that that it's going to be very difficult, because just in the area that we primarily work in, which is housing, people come in and they buy up buildings and they get rid of tenants with no regard to the law. We have one case right now where there was a case with that just happened to Julius Gray, and they were talking about Article 1936, where you're no longer a tenant, you become a subtenant because you rent. Anyway, long story like that, and the landlord is trying to throw out this 73-year-old lady with no proof whatsoever. So we sent legal letters saying, look, she's over 70, give her a break, just prove that she's changed status.
Right.
More than what you say. They don't care. They are going to make, when they get rid of her, probably $750,000 from her apartment, and they don't care. There's going to be one of the fine, upstanding members of society who's rich.
Ted, stay with us. We have Saul calling from Point Claire. Saul, welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The gentlemen have very good points, and I have a funny theory about it. I think it stems from the Army. When the Army started calling a hammer a handheld percussive instrument...
You mean a rose isn't a rose is a rose anymore.
Absolutely. It made us politically correct, and if I'm stupid, then I'm intellectually challenged, and we have become so afraid to call a spade, that all this, and plus the intrusion of privacy, and I have a big credit card company that...
We're afraid to tell authority to get off our backs. It's enough.
Absolutely.
We don't
absolutely
need to be perfected. We need to be protected.
Yeah. And this credit card company gave me an R5, okay, when I paid according to the term established by the contract. And I applied to work at one of the large banks in Montreal, and they did a credit bureau, of course, on me. And they come to see me and say, Saul, what's the matter with your credit? They said, what the heck is the matter with my credit? I got nothing
wrong
with
it. You didn't even know. You had no notice.
I didn't even know. So I phoned the credit card company, and I told them, look, guys, you're costing me a potential executive job with one of the largest banks. I have a good friend of mine who's a lawyer.
And what was their response? Did they send you your file right away?
Well, I told them that I would sue them, and my friend wouldn't charge me anything, okay? 24 hours later, fortunately, they took the R5 off, and I got my job.
And that's what's important as far as having representation. Gentlemen, before I let you go, Ted Wright, Westmount Legal, can you give our listeners the number if they need help?
Well, we're once a week at the Westmount YMCA between 3:30 and 6:30, and we're donation-based nonprofit.
And is there a number any the listeners can call?
No, because we'll get too many calls.
It's just walk-in.
Yeah, walk-in clinic every Wednesday at 3:30.
Thank you, gentlemen. Montreal will be right back with you after the news. Good morning, Montreal. Beryl Wiseman sitting in for Aphrodite Salas. We go now to a world issue with Canadian implications. Zahra Kazemi, Canadian photojournalist, was brutally tortured and killed in Iran. Her son, Stefan Hashemi, lives in Montreal. He's been trying to get her body back. The United Nations has reconstituted its old Human Rights Commission into what's called a Human Rights Council. The reason they did this was because the old Human Rights Commission had great defenders of civil liberties, such as China and Cuba and even Iran on it. Now, the reconstituted council still refused to institute minimum standards of transparency for membership on this Human Rights Council, and all nations, even those nations that didn't win a seat to the 47-member council, were allowed to send observers. Iran sent Saeed Mortazavi, who was the Tehran prosecutor in the Kazemi case and was alleged to have beaten her over the head with a shoe. He was sent under full diplomatic protection as an observer to the UN Human Rights Council's first meeting. Former Montrealer Hillel Neuer, who's director of the Geneva-based UN Watch, said that he was shocked to see him in the hall, and there was nothing more obscene than someone who's allegedly been involved in torture and possible murder sitting there as a dignitary. His presence, said Payam Akhavan, an international law professor at McGill University, makes a mockery of the council and is an open expression of defiance by Iran. Now, Canada has always maintained a very strong attachment and affinity to the United Nations. Canada's even called an apologist for the United Nations. Now, here's a case where we weren't able to protect one of our own citizens, still can't get her body back, and Iran, in sending this man as observer, simply mocks what the United Nations is supposed to stand for. And joining us now to discuss what Canada should do as far as even sending signals out both to a nation like Iran and what its policies changes should be to the United Nations is Alistair Gordon, president of the Canadian Coalition for Democracies. Thanks for joining us, Alistair.
Thanks for having me, Beryl. Pleasure to be here.
Is this more of the same from the UN? Have we just about given up trying to expect anything better?
Yeah, I mean, it was absolutely no surprise to me. I mean, it's absolutely consistent that something called a Human Rights Council should have as members Cuba and Saudi Arabia, you know, countries that have notorious human rights records. I think we have to look at the UN.
Saudi Arabia, let's remind our listeners, who kept a Canadian William Sampson jailed for 3.5 years, jailed and tortured.
That's right. In other words, we have Saudi Arabia sitting there that was the jailer and torturer of Bill Sampson. And now we have as an observer Saeed Mortazavi, who not only presided over a process that included torture and murder, but apparently was part of the physical torture himself.
Alistair
Gordon is now sitting as an observer.
Please stay with us. Back with you right after the break, and we'll talk about what Canada can do and what signals we should send. Montreal will be right back. Montreal, Beryl Wiseman sitting in for Aphrodite Salas. And we're talking about Iran mocking the new Human Rights Council of the United Nations. Canadian photojournalist Zahra Kazemi, who was arrested, tortured, and killed just for taking pictures in Tehran several years ago. Her body still not returned to Canada to her son, Stefan Hashemi. Her prosecutor, Saeed Mortazavi, together with the Iranian Justice Minister, Jamal Karimi-Rad, who was spokesperson, the apologist for the Iranian judiciary after Kazemi's arrest, torture, and murder 17 days later, go to New York under diplomatic protection and attend the new Human Rights Council as observers, even though Iran, thankfully, couldn't get a seat on the 47-member council. Canada responded to this with a statement from Foreign Affairs Minister Peter McKay's office that there's reason why Iran is not on the council. It's appalling record on human rights. Now, with us is Alistair Gordon, president of the Canadian Coalition for Democracies. Alistair, how can we take this statement further? This government has been pretty good on human rights issues and sending the right optic out into the world. Where do we go from here? What can we encourage Canada to do?
Well, I think that any attempts at reforming a lot of the UN bodies have proven futile. I believe that a travesty such as we're witnessing now in something called a Human Rights Council, which has a torturer sitting as an observer and has Cuba and Saudi Arabia as elected members, I believe that Canada should take a fairly dramatic position and withdraw from it. However, it seems that the temptation to be part of the lofty UN bodies is just too much for any politician to resist. But if we want to send a signal, that's what we need to do. In fact, I'm not shocked at all that a torturer is sitting as an observer in New York with full diplomatic protection, a Human Rights Council. I'm not really surprised at all.
He beat her on the head, according to French newspaper Libération. He allegedly struck her on the head repeatedly with a shoe.
Right.
This is the quality of person sitting as an observer from Iran.
And Cuba and Saudi Arabia are the quality of the elected members. But
I'm surprised North Korea hasn't sent somebody.
That's right. But, I mean, this doesn't surprise me at all. What would absolutely shock me was if I was to witness something done by the UN that was just and right. That would be the shocker. This is just a continuation of a very long saga. The UN has evolved into an organization that represents the interests of the absolute worst governments on the planet. And since they now seem to constitute a majority, and the Western liberal democracies seem to be paralyzed by guilt and fear and oil hunger, we have a situation in which it is not surprising that the UN has evolved into what it has.
The arguments are often made by those who are pro-UN, by those who are, we could say, on the quote, left, unquote, that we have to recognize the sovereignty of governments, and particularly democratically elected governments. Now, thankfully, Prime Minister Harper, in one of his first comments on this kind of an issue, which was the election of Hamas and the Palestinian Authority, said, yes, it's a democratic election, and we have to recognize it as such, but there has to be a legitimacy underlying even a democratically elected government, and that legitimacy must be transparency, fidelity to freedom, and the renunciation of violence. Can we not make that a standard for Western? I wonder if we can't have a new protocol among Western nations saying, okay, UN, you know, if you don't go to this standard, we will simply withdraw from all the political side of the United Nations. We'll stay active in the good works of the United Nations on children's relief, conflict resolution, but nothing political.
Well, I agree, and I think that Peter McKay and Stephen Harper have taken leadership positions, even globally. The withdrawal of funding to the Hamas-dominated Palestinian Authority, you know, the vote in support of Israel again in the beginning of this year's anti-Israel resolution ritual at the UN, the Air India inquiry, and so on. These are leadership positions that they're taking, and I think another leadership opportunity would be for Peter McKay to register in some fairly visible and maybe even dramatic way that he does not believe that the United Nations Human Rights Council will in any way stand for human rights in the world. I think something like that needs to be done because everything else has been tried. You know, the name change, for example.
Which was remarkable. The Human Rights Commission to the Human Rights Council. And what was that supposed to do?
Well, Kofi Annan said that was going to be a clean break from
of
the
course,
past,
yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, clearly it's not a clean break. We can see what it is. And Canada always has the option of reentering that august body should it reform itself. But as it stands today, what Canada's doing is legitimizing torture, legitimizing the abuse of human rights by being part of the pretense that the UN Human Rights Commission stands for human rights when it clearly doesn't.
Alistair Gordon, we'll be right back with you after this, and we'll talk about what Canada can do to protect Canadian citizens abroad that they have failed to do in the Iranian case. Montreal will be right back after this. Montreal, Beryl Wiseman sitting in for Aphrodite Salas. This half hour, we're talking about how Iran is mocking the United Nations and its new Human Rights Council in particular. This nation that threatens to wipe Israel off the map, this nation headed by a president who espouses open hatred for Christians and Jews, this nation of Iran that was kept off the new Human Rights Council, sends as an observer with full diplomatic protection, Prosecutor Saeed Mortazavi, who was implicated in the death of Iranian-Canadian photojournalist Zahra Kazemi, the torture and death of Zahra Kazemi, and this man who represents a nation who still has not released her body. We've been talking with Alistair Gordon, president of the Canadian Coalition for Democracies. Alistair, what has Canada's failure, almost impotence, in the past several years to get back Zahra Kazemi's body say to Canadians about the ability of our country, never mind its position in the UN, the moral high ground, and we all know the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and we think that this government has good intentions, but where's our muscle? We can't get a body back.
Well, there is something that could be done, and it's a remedy that's available to citizens of the United States who have suffered damages, injury, death, or death or injury of members of their family as a result of the terrorist actions of foreign governments, and that is the ability to sue those foreign governments. That is not a right. That is a right that the last government resisted very strongly, giving to Canadians who were victims of terror. Stockwell Day does have a bill. I'm not too sure of the status of it, but if we were to give that right to Canadians, then, for example, Stephen Kazemi could then sue for damages for a very large amount of
money. His name
is
Stefan Hashemi, by the way. He doesn't share the same name.
Stefan Hashemi. I'm sorry. Yes, you're right. Stefan could then sue for damages. It could be a very sizable amount. He could sue for $1 billion in damages, for example. And that quantity of Iranian assets would then be seized in Canada pending the court case, the outcome of the court case. That has proven extremely successful in Italy, for example, in seizing Iranian assets. So that is one mechanism.
Indeed, just to expand on that, Alistair, there is an American law firm headed by a gentleman named Ronald Corey, I believe, from North Carolina, who is doing a class action suit on behalf of victims of 9/11 against Saudi Arabia and other nations, and he's being allowed to do that in the United States.
That's correct. That's Ron Motley. Exactly.
Motley, I'm sorry, not
yep.
Corey.
We're really getting last names wrong today. But
it happens.
It happens. Ron Motley, yes, it's a $1 trillion lawsuit, the O'Neill lawsuit. And it is increasingly where governments prove impotent, civil action by individuals are proving to be extremely powerful.
Would that kind of a procedure be possible? Would that kind of a legal attempt even be possible in Canada?
It would absolutely be possible if this bill were to be passed, thus allowing Canadians to sue foreign entities for damages as a result of terrorism, torture, improper detention, and so on and so forth.
In other words, allowing Canadians to do what the law lords in Britain refused to for William Sampson, who wanted to sue Saudi Arabia in Britain.
Correct, exactly. Now, William Sampson, as a Canadian, could come back here, should such a law be passed in Canada, and sue Saudi Arabia and result in the seizure of Saudi assets in Canada, which I imagine are quite considerable. So, you know, there's so much wealth in the Middle East, despite the impoverishment of 90% of its population, and they do not want to see those assets seized or removed from them.
They want their money to keep making money and keep shelling out the $20,000 per suicide bomber.
That's exactly what they want. So that's one step, would be to allow Canadians to sue foreign governments for damages, civil damages, arising from terrorist actions. And, of course, the other way would be for Canada to leave the UN Human Rights Council. We seem to harbor under the impression that if we're there, we can change it from the inside. Well, that has completely failed. So why keep doing the same thing when it's not working, when it's not making any difference,
and
when
in fact,
the patient's not getting any better?
Membership by Western countries is actually used by Islamist propaganda to show, well, we must be doing something right because they're there.
Exactly. In other words, we're not changing it, we're legitimizing it. We're having the exact opposite effect. And I think, therefore, let's try some new medicine on this sick patient, and that new medicine might just to be to very visibly withdraw and let the world know that Canada thinks that the UN Human Rights Council is a travesty, and unless it's reconstituted, its rulings and positions will have absolutely no legitimacy.
Well, Alistair Gordon, as long as people like you, as president of the Canadian Coalition for Democracies, don't visibly withdraw, this country will move forward in the proper direction. I thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Beryl.
Montreal, we'll be back after the news. Montreal, we're back. Beryl Wiseman sitting in for Aphrodite Salas. You know, we often face so much in our life and in this modern world, as we were talking earlier with Julius Gray and Ted Wright, of government oversight, electronic controls, state engineering, laws everywhere we look, that the consequence of each of us as an individual is lost sight of. We lose sight of what the fundamental basis of any free society is. What Emerson said, one person, resolute, abiding by the truth, shall rally a majority. The courage to feel that way has become nullified in our society. But every now and then, there are people who pop up who say, no, I'm not going to take it anymore. I'm not going to go with the conventional wisdom. I'll stand up, lone individual, unbacked by privilege or preference, and take on major institutions. And this next hour, we'll be talking to two of these types of people, people of courage, people of resolve, who simply want to exercise their rights as free men and women in this society. One is taking on one of Canada's largest labor unions. The other, who we'll be talking to at 10:30, is taking on the Quebec government, and maybe taking the Quebec government to the United Nations. But our first guest is Daniel Nadler. Daniel is a 23-year-old teaching assistant at the University of Toronto. And because of that position, he is automatically a member of CUPE, Canadian Union of Public Employees Ontario Wing, which, as many of you listeners must know, some 10 days ago, passed an anti-Israel resolution calling on its members to boycott Israeli products, calling Israel an apartheid state. It was wrong in its facts. And for the leaders of CUPE not to have known that they were wrong in their facts, they had to have wanted not to know. There was a purposeful misleading of its membership. And that constitutes part of what our next guest, Daniel Nadler's argument is with CUPE, and he is looking at his legal options to take CUPE to court. Daniel Nadler, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Tell us the background of what you're planning.
Well, sure. I don't know how up-to-date your guests are, but pretty much everyone across the country knows by now about Resolution 50 and the stance that CUPE has taken.
CUPE Ontario.
Yeah, CUPE Ontario has taken against Israel. CUPE National has, to a certain extent, distanced themselves from that stance.
So, a very kind of watered-down statement. CUPE National, just for our listeners to know, said, we will not be encouraging any of our locals or regional affiliates to participate in the Israeli boycott.
Right, so it's sort of a lukewarm distancing, but it's really the...
I think it's what Woodward and Bernstein called a non-denial denial.
Right. But CUPE Ontario, led by Sid Ryan and the executive there, have taken a stance on Resolution 50. I mean, they're actually quite responsible for advancing Resolution 50 to the delegates at the convention. And Resolution 50, among other things that involve taking a stance against Israel, criticizing Israel for all of its policies, quite clearly calls upon the union membership to spend money on developing an education campaign about the apartheid nature of the Israeli state. And it's in that respect that they've really sort of crossed a threshold or crossed a Rubicon, so to speak. Unions, for many years, have been taking stances on political issues. For many years, CUPE Ontario has been taking stances on Israel. But this is the first time, to the best of my knowledge and to the best of the knowledge of many lawyers across the country, that any union has passed a resolution requiring the union membership to spend their own dues, which they're forced to pay by virtue of being part of the collective bargaining unit, on a education program about a cause that's on the other side of the world, about Middle Eastern geopolitics, and about an issue that is manifestly irrelevant to the vast majority of the 200,000 members, of the more than 200,000 members.
And so, this is the crux of your challenge, and we'll examine it more in depth right after this. Montreal, we're back. And just before we get back with Daniel Nadler and discussing his challenge to CUPE, the Supreme Court of Canada has just ruled that Canada's system of no-fault divorce does not preclude courts from factoring in emotional consequences of misconduct in spousal support. And this is what we were talking about in our first half hour with lawyer Linda Hammerschmidt, who was hoping that Canadian family law would not go back to these issues of fault and which strictly stay on the questions of need. The court went on to say in a very nuanced judgment that emotional trauma, whatever its source, may be considered by trial judges as another factor in a person's financial outlook. Bit of a remarkable piece of legal decision-making. Daniel Nadler, I hope you don't mind that interruption, but I know that you have a great interest in things judicial as well, which we'll get into.
Sure.
So, the crux of your argument with CUPE is that it's using union dollars to educate union members. You have no problem with unions taking stands on international social justice issues.
Right.
But that it's using union dollars to do an educational campaign, not a general campaign, but a campaign with almost a premeditated focus and outcome.
Right. The focus is this. The union has a fixed amount of time, energy, money, resources that it can spend, period. Sid Ryan has a fixed amount of all of those things that he can spend. My issue, and the issue that we're trying to advance through the court system, is whether they can take a substantial portion of that, what might turn out to be a substantial portion of all of those things, and direct it to a cause that doesn't directly advance the interests of its membership. In CUPE Ontario, I'm sure this is the case across the CUPE locals across the country, but in CUPE Ontario, there's a serious situation faced by the membership here in all sorts of different employment categories. For example, the employment category that I'm part of, teaching assistants, face a situation where you have students spending 4 or 5 or 6 years completing their PhD and then graduating to face sessional teaching positions where they're making $7,000 to $8,000 a class, where they're teaching students that in many cases over the summer are making more than they are. So it's not as if QP Ontario has no substantial barriers and obstacles to overcome in respect of the interests of their actual membership. So then to, in that situation, go and start spending money, time, energy, and resources on Middle Eastern geopolitical conflicts, to my mind, is a reckless and negligent disregard of the fiduciary responsibility that a union leadership has to
Dan,
its membership.
Dan, how would you respond to those who say to you, let me rephrase that, how would you respond to those who take the following position? It is wrong for QP to have done what it did because the facts presented to its members were wrong. It is not wrong for a union to take positions, even spending money to educate the public on broad social justice issues. Are you going as far as to say that unions should not take social justice issues if they don't directly impact their members?
No, well, we're not trying to do that, because that actually has been resolved in law in the Levine decision in 1991, and they can. What we're trying to see is whether they can spend money in ways that are not clearly permitted by their own constitution, because what's interesting is QP Ontario's constitution not only directs the organization in their objective statement, directs the organization to spend money on causes directly related to collective bargaining, but every single clause in the objective is followed by in Ontario, in Ontario, in Ontario. So what we're trying to simply ask is, can they spend money in ways that clearly violate the objectives stated in their own constitution? If they want to change their constitution,
right,
by all means, go try. We're trying to say that insofar as they haven't yet changed their constitution, this is unconstitutional, and then therefore the executive is directing the union resources and union energy to a cause that is in direct contravention of what's permitted by their own constitution.
Now, just to enlighten our listeners, and you and I talked about this before, in Ontario, the Ontario Labor Relations Act says that no union executive shall knowingly mislead union members on any issue.
Right.
Will you be making, or are you looking at making use of that in the context of QP's resolution?
Absolutely, and that's the other side of this coin that we really want to address. You know, I got an email, I got after the article was published in National Post, I got tens if not hundreds of emails, but I got one specific email from a QP member, who was actually at that convention and voted in favor of that resolution. And what she said to me was this. She said, you know what, when we were voting on that resolution, I didn't know what the word apartheid meant.
And this is in reference to the fact that the resolution called Israel's security fence an apartheid wall.
Right, exactly, and they called Israel an apartheid state. So, and she said, at the time of the resolution, I didn't know what apartheid meant.
The very word, the definition.
Exactly. And
never mind that she didn't know that Israel has Arab judges, Arab members of parliament, Arab diplomats, and Jews can't get visas to Arab lands.
Right.
She just didn't even know the word.
The word apartheid. Now, no definition was given at the convention before the vote. Apartheid is a very specialized, specific word that has a very specific meaning within a very specific context, which we can get to in a moment.
Particularly in our time.
Right, and particularly at a particular historical time. But after the vote, she went home, she looked up the word apartheid in a dictionary, she looked up the historical connotation of the word apartheid in an encyclopedia, and to her shock, to what she said, her utter amazement, that is not what she voted for at all. She completely disagreed after looking up what the word meant with calling Israel an apartheid state, and that she felt so bad, so overwhelmingly guilty for this, and then she writes this in the email at length, and that there are other members of the union who actually voted in favor of this resolution who are in the same position, and her own friends who are in the same position. So what we're trying to ask is, how responsible is it, and more than how responsible is it negligent or criminal misrepresentation when the president of the union goes and writes articles,
and the executive of the union,
the executive of the union, and specifically the president of the union, said Ryan, goes and writes articles in the Toronto Star and other newspapers across the country calling Israel an apartheid state, which is plainly and factually incorrect in respect of the specialized meaning of that term, and then goes and asks the union leadership to vote in favor of this resolution, and it goes and asks the union membership, moreover, to vote in favor of this resolution, a membership and a leadership that look at him as a leader, look at him as a role model,
and yet this very president and this very union executive has never taken a stand against the fact that in all Arab countries, unions are illegal, that they have never taken a stand against suicide terror. They've never taken a stand against women being beheaded for sleeping with men other than their husbands.
Right.
That is not on their radar screen. Daniel Nather, we'll be right back with you after this. Montreal, Beryl Wiseman here, sitting in for Aphrodite Salas, and we're talking to Daniel Nadler, who's taking on CUPE over their anti-Israel boycott resolution. Dan, we just finished talking about what was wrong with the resolution and the big lies in it, and as Uncle Joe Stalin said, the broad mass of the people will believe a big lie, fasten a small one, repeat it often enough. But here's a piece of news that I found out since we last talked, which was that out of some 250,000 members of CUPE Ontario, the convention supposedly had 896 delegates.
Right.
And CUPE's been putting out the word that this was a unanimous vote. I found out that the actual number of delegates in the room when this vote happened was under 500, and people really weren't aware of what was being voted on. Would it surprise you to learn that?
Well, actually, there are a number of other procedural issues which have come to my attention. Not only that, the vote was held on a Saturday morning. Whether that was specifically designed to preclude more religious Jews from attending is an open question. The vote was pushed off to the very end of the convention when many of the delegates had already left. And it was coupled with a nice bit of entertainment. Apparently, right before the vote, a rapper who went up on stage and started rapping about anger and racism, and this immediately preceded the vote. Instead of a definition of the words included in the resolution, they decided to precede the vote with a rapper.
Remarkable. Those last two things are more telling than anything else. I mean, I think it's very hard for any organization to go around every particularity of religion, but those last two things are very telling. Are you facing any pressure from CUPE over what you've done and the article in the National Post and you going public?
No, I mean, it's the exact opposite. I've just been continuously getting emails from CUPE members who say, you know what, substantively, I might agree, I might disagree with the Israel issue, Israel foreign policy, but I don't even want to talk about Israel. I don't even want to talk about foreign policy. What I want to talk about is the reckless disregard of the interests of its membership that the CUPE leadership, the CUPE executive, in particular Sid Ryan, take.
By the way, I just want to mention to our listeners, this is the second time for this show, because I tried to get Sid Ryan on my show on Sundays, where I have four national labor leaders condemning this resolution and condemning CUPE Ontario. He would not come on my show. He would not come on today. I just want to make that for the record.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting because...
Although he has been on another show here, but he just won't come on with me, I guess. I don't know.
Well, I mean, maybe he's spending his time writing articles for newspapers.
Well, that's important. There you go.
One of the interesting questions is these articles that he's writing, this time that he's spending explaining why he thinks Israel is an apartheid state, is he using union hours to do this? And when journalists are calling him and he's defending why he thinks Israel is an apartheid state to journalists on the phone, are they calling him between the hours of 9 and 5?
Well, actually, he was on this show, on Aphrodite Salas. He gave a very short interview to Aphrodite several weeks ago, or 10
right.
days ago, and he said he was calling from a picket line.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible. If you take a CEO, if you take a lawyer, if you take a doctor, if you take any other person who exists in some sort of profession or situation where they have a responsibility to a client or to a shareholder or so on, and if they were to start answering phone calls at 2:30 in the afternoon about who they believe will win the World Cup, they would be ejected the next day from that position of responsibility. But that's exactly analogous to what Sid Ryan seems to be doing.
Especially if they're taking the calls in the middle of a board meeting.
He seems to be taking phone calls at 2:30 in the afternoon and
on a picket line,
explaining at length why Israel's an apartheid state. And the question that all of these, you asked me what was the reaction, the question that all of these union members are asking is this the person who we want leading our union? Is this the person who looks out for the best interest of the union membership, which in a direct and very immediate way do not include the geopolitics of the Middle East? And that's really the question that we're trying to advance to the court, not whether unions in general can take political stances, not whether unions in general can support the NDP, because there's a rational connection between a union and the NDP, and there's a rational connection between supporting the NDP. But is there a rational connection between the presidents of a union spending his time and union dues on Middle Eastern geopolitics? And that's really what we're trying to figure out.
Daniel Nadler, more power to you.
Thanks.
Montreal, we'll be back. Montreal, we're back. Beryl Wiseman sitting in for Aphrodite Salas. We're talking this hour about individuals who take on big institutions, big brother, and they're not afraid, and they don't have privilege and preference, and they just had enough. Our next guest is the director of Injustice Quebec, and he started this organization over a case of a man wrongfully convicted, Michel Dumont, released from prison, and now the government refuses victims' compensation. And Carlo Turini, director of Injustice Quebec, has forged a remarkable coalition and may very well take Quebec to the United Nations. Carlo Turini, welcome.
Good morning, Beryl.
Tell us a bit about the Dumont case.
Michel Dumont is just your average Joe, an electrician who was some 10 years ago, he was arrested for a rape he didn't commit. The lady quickly met with the police, signed an affidavit saying that it was not Michel Dumont who had committed this heinous crime, and the information was never turned over to his attorney.
How is that possible?
Well, it's
we know it happened because mm-hmm. Dumont has been released, but how did that happen?
Well,
in the process.
I think we would have to ask some people at the Justice Ministry of Quebec, and they're not talking much these days. So my gut feeling is that this is not an isolated event. We've seen many cases where there are similar circumstances.
Milgaard, Moran, Marshall, on and on and on. So what happens to Dumont? He's convicted?
He's convicted. He serves his entire sentence in jail over 3 years. His children are taken away from him. And finally, when he is cleared, when finally the victim goes on, meets with the media, tells him that this is not the right guy, he is cleared. It takes a couple of years for him to get...
Why did it take 4 years for the victim to meet with the media or even during the trial to come out and say, hey, this piece of information is not coming out and this isn't the guy?
Well, I think your average citizen figures that when they sign an affidavit and they turn it over to police, they meet with the Crown attorney and they tell him that it's the wrong guy, that the wheels of justice are gonna actually enact something that's going to change the situation.
And it really doesn't. It's what Julius Gray called earlier in the program, the need for a moral revolution, people to really get mad about this kind of stuff.
Well, hallelujah. And that's what we're doing at Injustice Quebec. We're picking up these cases, which are miserable failures of justice, and we're denouncing them. We're blowing the lid off the situation. We're blowing the lid off the Charest government, who is really not interested in these individual cases.
Now, let's get back to a chronology, the timeline here. So Michel Dumont goes to jail. He's released after 4 years, serves his whole sentence.
That's right.
And when does this information come out that he was not the guy?
Well, just about a few weeks before he's actually released, before he's actually served his full sentence. So, in fact...
How did it happen?
Well, the lady, as I said, goes public with the facts, and then, you know, everybody's got pie on their face, and they enact an investigation, and he is finally cleared through an investigation and through...
an official investigation of the Department of Justice.
That's right.
Unbelievable. And Carlo, bear with me for a moment. We've got to pay some bills. We'll be right back with you. Montreal, we're back. Beryl Wiseman here sitting in for Aphrodite Salas, and we're talking to Carlo Turini, director of Injustice Quebec, on the rights of the wrongfully convicted. And if anybody has experience with this, we want to hear from you. Carlo, Michel Dumont serves 4 years for rape, is found completely cleared. The victim writes a letter. The evidence comes out. The Department of Justice clears him. Why can't he get compensation?
Well, that's the question we're asking, and the only thing we can imagine is that there is no urgency as far as Quebec's justice minister is concerned to settle cases like that. And this is not an isolated case. We've seen cases where one gentleman has been waiting around for 30 years for the government to address it.
You know, it's a sad thing what you just said. There's no urgency. The only urgency for people to go into public service should be the reduction of suffering of the people. Instead, we have government that makes statocratic laws, that tweaks the system, that makes little things for the next flyers for the election, and doesn't give a twit about the suffering of people.
Well, we all heartedly agree. I mean, if you're a special interest in Quebec today and, you know, you're bucking for a condo development in a national park, I mean, you can get legislation introduced in a matter of weeks, if not months. And while if you're an innocent citizen, you know, who's never had a traffic ticket to his name and you're wrongfully convicted, sent to jail, well, then you can't look to the state for any type of compensation.
You said Injustice Quebec has uncovered other cases. How many have there been?
Oh, we have at least a dozen cases that are so similar that it's remarkably...
They're not all rape cases, obviously.
No, some of them are false confessions. There was a gentleman in Quebec City who was mentally deficient, and through a shoddy police investigation and you know, questions that were asked you know, from somebody who's got you know, the intellectual capacities of an 8-year-old, he was made to sign
a confession on things he didn't do.
Well, he signed a confession that he had raped 5 women in Quebec City.
Amazing.
And then he served his full sentence in jail. Then he was released, and then there were more rapes. You can imagine it wasn't him doing it. So
now,
they knocked at his door, and he was headed for the same process a second time.
The United Nations issue comes in how? Canada's a signatory. Quebec's a signatory to the United Nations Conventions.
That's right. There was an agreement signed in 1976 by Canada, and Quebec signed as well an agreement to this, that all victims of wrongful convictions would have a program whereby they could be compensated in a reasonable amount of time. Now, in most cases, it just doesn't happen. So what we're saying is, we called the UN and we wrote a letter and we were surprised. We actually got a response.
Really? Which division of the UN?
This is the
Human Rights.
Yes, United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, who's asked Quebec and the federal government to answer to the allegations that we have raised. And
you wrote to which office? There's Ottawa, New York, there's The Hague. Where did you write?
We wrote to the office located in Geneva.
Right.
And we got a very quick response, and we were, you know, after waiting years from the Quebec government and the Justice Minister to respond, we were surprised that they would be willing to take up the case. So the government's got 6 months to produce its position, and basically there is no position that they can produce. It's just that, you know, well,
because they cleared him, they investigated and they cleared him.
Exactly, and he fits the bill for compensation, and Michel Dumont is still waiting. And it's certainly a second injustice after the first injustice of being wrongfully convicted.
Now, you're not just relying on lawyers and paperwork. You, Carla Tarini, and Injustice Quebec have a homegrown little pressure cooker that you've built, which is a speaker's corner at the corner of Parc La Fontaine and Rochelle every Sunday at 1 o'clock. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, that's right. We decided you need to give the microphone to people who've been victims of such situations, not only wrongful convictions, but any citizen who feels
frustration.
Any frustration should be allowed to speak out. And what we've been doing for the past 5 weeks is we stage a speaker's corner, very similar to the one in London's Hyde Park, where people come up and they get up on top of a wooden box, and we have a microphone, and they can. They can cleanse themselves and denounce injustices. And we also, as part of our commitment, we invite the media every Sunday to come along and to listen and to hopefully feed off these cases and to write stories and publish.
You know, you make it almost tempting for me to show up one Sunday.
Well, we certainly hope you will.
I'm not sure that that's a promise or a threat.
Well, you know, we certainly would like to hear from you, Beryl, but we also want to hear from the average Joe. And God knows that there are an awful lot of people who have been victimized by this government.
Over and over and over and over and over.
Quebec's Human
Rights League. We just dehumanized our system.
Well, you know, and Quebec's Human Rights League published a study recently which compared the state of democracy in Quebec for the average citizen to the time of Duplessis.
Le noirceur.
La grande noirceur. Well, we've got that second great darkness gone.
You know, our governments, federal and provincial, don't realize that when you protect the rights of the smallest, the rights of the largest group will be protected. But if you just do collective engineering, the rights of the individual will fall. And, you know, it's very interesting. You went to the UN, and the United Nations has called Canada the most invasive society on trampling of individual rights and liberties in the G7 for 5 years in a row. It's a remarkable thing. Very few people know about this.
Well, it's not exactly news to me with the case that I've seen. Because when you line them up, you just get a list of degrading gestures by the government. And you know, if the average citizen catches a traffic ticket, he has to do the right thing and he has to settle up with the state.
Not the state.
Well, it's just not right.
But we'll make it right. Carlo Tarini, with people like you, we'll make it right. Before you go, website, injusticequebec.com or .org?
www.injusticequebec.ca for any of your listeners who want to know more about the situation and who would like to have their voices.
And
there,
I'll invite everybody to come to Rachel, the corner of Rachel and Parc La Fontaine, Sundays at 1 on the Speaker's Corner. Carlo Tarini, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, Beryl.
We'll be right back. Montreal, this is Beryl Wiseman sitting in for Aphrodite Salas, and now for a look ahead, we're going to talk to Ken Connors in the Express Line. Hi, Ken. What's up?
Beryl, love the show.
Thank you, sir. Love yours. What's up? What do we got today?
Hey,
what's
Beryl,
making him crazy?
Beryl, it's a hot summer day. You're walking down St. Catherine. You got your jacket off. You loosen your tie. You're in the mood for an ice cream. Why shouldn't you be allowed to buy an ice cream?
Absolutely. Why?
The Villemarie Borough was originally going to go for it,
but
the restaurant owners got together, the downtown merchants got together, they said, you know what, it's going to hurt our business, going to take too big a chunk out of our business.
And an ice cream.
The city has nixed it. But Beryl, my question is, if this could work in Manhattan...
And you get pretzels in Manhattan. You know, we used to have pretzels in Montreal, but Mayor Drapeau thought it was ugly because they made dirt and crumbs.
Is that right?
Yeah. There were pretzel vendors in the late 50s and early 60s in the Plateau.
You know, I mean, if you can have this flourishing hot dog stand business in Manhattan, why, you know, and it certainly doesn't stop people from opening shops in Manhattan and coffee shops. And
let's not forget the hot dogs.
Yeah, exactly. Why couldn't that happen here in Montreal?
I don't know. Do you ever think it's just because governments, I don't care if they're borough, municipal, provincial, federal, just look for something to oppose. First to dismiss, last to discuss. It's like a mentality in government. We don't want to touch anything that doesn't work, since the main things don't work. Healthcare doesn't work. The roads don't work. We don't have enough cops. They're underfunded. Nothing works. So let's touch the little shit.
I know. So listen, we're gonna open the phone lines at 11 o'clock and ask our listeners here on the Union of 40 whether they agree with this position from the restaurant owners that is going to cut into their business to have the odd ice cream vendor out on the streets of St. Catherine and Sherbrooke and Crescent de Maisonneuve this summer.
And I'm sure you're going to have a lot of people calling in just saying, you know, we want to be a little more free when we walk. I was getting into a taxi the other day,
yeah,
and the taxi driver says to me, too much law, just like that, too much law.
Listen, Beryl, before I let you go, do you own a shredder?
Well, I heard Carolyn say this morning that she just bought one.
Yeah, yeah. It's our question of the day. We're going to be going to the phones during the noon hour, the lunch hour on this, the noon news. Do you worry about the security of your personal financial information?
It's a real important question.
Absolutely. And
it's critical.
More and more people are concerned about it and a little almost paranoid about it. And I think there's been a spike in the sale of shredders in the last couple of years. So we'll
But truly, it's the information age and it's information rape.
Yeah, absolutely. So listen, it's all coming up in a couple of minutes after our 11 o'clock.
Sounds terrific.
And we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Great, Ken.
All right, Beryl.
Terrific. Montreal, that's all for us. Have a great day.